anyone with the headphones on, so I apologize. I was just kind of extemporaneously making a few points about the political nature of standards and the important issue, public policy issues, and I went through a couple, including search privacy standards, including making electronic books accessible from various platforms. It would be really very strange for me to get on the internet on one particular browser and only be able to access certain websites. We're used to a certain interoperability there, but we also expect interoperability in things like electronic books, like peer-produced applications, like social networking. So I just went through a couple of those. And I think what I'll do is I will pass the mic on to someone else, but I did have a question. Since we have a lot of intelligence in this room, I wanted to hear from people about what they think the issues are. What are the important issues? What is this open standards issue about? What are the top three issues? What are some tangible policy areas that can be addressed? Does anyone want to grab the mic and talk about that? This is really an open session for discussion. It's not about us being up in the front of the room just rattling on, but we really wanted it to be a little bit more interactive. So would someone like to raise their hand and give a couple of thoughts about what the important issues are?
So my name is Daniel Dardaye. I work for the W3C, World Wide Web Consortium, with the organization doing standard for XML, HTML, HTTP, all the web protocols and formats. So the W3C has had a very aggressive patent policy, aggressive compared to the other peer organization, in the sense that we push for royalty-free standard from the beginning, and we're really enforcing the fact that everything that we recommend as a standard is going to be licensed on that base. So there is really a patent pool that is being formed around the W3C format and protocol. So that's one thing. And our experience is that we'd like others to do the same as we do, because we think it works fine. I mean, we have all the industry playing this game with W3C. Microsoft, IBM, Sun, you know, most of the people that were member of W3C continue to be member of W3C under the new patent policy. So there is really adoption from the industry as well. And we'd like to have other organizations look at the way we've done that, because it's not just royalty-free. It's really a series of right and obligation that comes with a pledge around the patent for web technology. And what we really like to see is that government that today give sort of official credential to some organization and not others, because they haven't been created around, you know, international treaty, then they consider a sort of a definition of open standard that is a set of criteria, and that they can, in a sense, mandate and use technology from any organization, whether they are official or not, providing that they match this set of criteria. Among which will be, you know, participation and IPR policy, of course, and, you know, things like that. So regarding accessibility, I'd like to mention something. W3C started a project 10 years ago in 97 called the Web Accessibility Initiative, because we realized that there were no single, you know, guidelines that everybody could use to make website more accessible to people with visual impairment in particular, but also deafness, you know, physical impairment, anything. So we produced this guideline as a W3C standard, no official, you know, whatever, because we're not an official organization, we're just a sort of a forum in a sense. And we realized that in Europe, starting in Europe, a lot of government adopted this guideline as part of their legislation or pre-legislation effort in sort of, you know, online administration. And that was a shock to the other official standard, because they have nothing to provide, you know, in replacement for that. This is the only sort of guideline in the area. So it was really a question of who should have done this work, you know, instead of W3C. And in fact, since it is based on a whole series of stack, you know, the IP stack and the web stack, the whole idea of, you know, where do the internet standards come from sort of raise of this debate over accessibility.
Another follow-up question for you. Does the W3C promote that accessibility guidelines through all of its standards efforts, all of its different working groups?
Yes, internally we have a domain for accessibility that's with several working groups. One of them is producing the guideline for the content, another one is producing guideline for the browser, another one guideline for the editing tools. There is a special working group in the domain, it's called Protocol and Format, and the only job of this group is to make sure that all the other 50 groups of W3C, you know, follow the accessibility guideline when they create new format. So if you want, the guidelines are for people using the format, but internally we have a guideline for people creating format. You have to include specific language and attribute in the format design in order for people to create accessible documents, so it's sort of the first step.
Good to hear, and I don't know, my knowledge, that's the only organization. I'm sure there have got to be others. There are hundreds and hundreds of standards consortia out there. The W3C is one of the best known, but I think that's something maybe as a coalition or as a group or as each of us here, it may go back to your own countries, your own organizations, thinks about is how can we, from the beginning of standards development, include accessibility principles. Another one that to consider including too is energy usage. You actually can write software that's energy efficient. Right, software that is going to lead to extra energy uses down the road. That's particularly true around how software uses drivers for external devices and things like that. And I'm not in a software engineer, so I don't know if this makes sense across the board. But that might be another one of those kind of cross-cutting things to inject to have the public interest better represented in standards. Is there anybody else from a standards organization? Anybody from ITU in here at all? That's somewhat concerning. That
IETF.
Yes. Great. Thank you. Is there anything from your experience at IETF that you think that I'm interested kind of more in capacity building? Is there anything that IETF does to try to get more engagement from developing economies, or is there?
No. My name is Stefan Bartmeier. As far as I know, there are not a lot of effort in IETF for capacity building because it is widely regarded as out of scope for IETF. But the parent organization, ISOC, has a system of fellowship for attendance from developing countries who want to go to an IETF meeting. They can have all travel and expenses paid, and they get a mentor who follows them during all the IETF session, explain, because IETF, like any standard development organization, like any human organization, IETF is very special. When you start, it's very difficult. You understand nothing, you know no one. People talk about a lot of things that they know for many years, and you're quite lost at the beginning. So it's a good thing to have the mentor. In practice, at every IETF meeting, there are 5 or 6 persons benefiting from this fellowship program. It's a good thing. This fellowship program is a very good thing, but it's, of course, only a drop in the ocean because there are many, many more problems. There is even an official document from IETF called IETF Problem Statement, which describes all the problems of the IETF with respect to outsiders, new people, beginners, people from developing countries. This document points a lot of problems, but provide no solutions. That's more difficult. But at least the problem is recognized. For instance, a document which is RFC 3330, if I'm correct. This RFC correctly notice that there is a big problem with the language because everything at IETF is in English. And sometimes fast English with a Texan accent, and it's very, very difficult from people from other countries. The culture of IETF is based on the fast exchange, fast and informal exchange, and it's very difficult when it's not in your language. So yes, there is an effort, but at the present time, when you go at IETF meeting, it's clear that the majority comes from OECD countries. Now we have more and more people from China, but typically they come, but they don't participate a lot for various reasons. Maybe because they don't speak English well enough and they do not dare to talk. It's perfectly possible.
Thanks. I think that's an interesting model for us to think about. I think. Did not know that.
My name is Ahmed. I'm from Bangladesh. The question to IETF, I just actually talked to Kevin Kramer of IETF just before this session. The thing, the fellowship program is mainly based on just calling people from engineer sector, mainly the technical sector. So this is a part of orientation. So far I understand that Kevin told me. But the other aspects, like, you know, the political aspects or the economic aspects, so whether the standard-setting organizations can take initiative, you know, to talk much about the economic aspects and also the political aspects, because it is, and then only the question that you told about the transparency and the openness can be, I think, yeah, it's much more better than to bring into an accountable relationship, because these things are highly technical. So how the civil society organizations, those who are working on the social sectors, so how they can even become benefited, even the organizations like the IETF or others, those who are setting standards.
Hello, I'm Henriette Esterhuizen from South Africa, from APC. I have a question and then maybe a suggestion. In terms of developing countries, the area that really is getting a lot of attention now is mobile, and the general solution that we are given to solve problems of access is through mobile internet and extension of mobile telephony in various ways. So I was wondering, firstly, it would be good to know where all the standards are being set for interconnection and applications in the mobile industry. And then secondly, that might be a good place to start with capacity building in developing countries, because developing country governments, well, particularly in Africa, which I have the most experience of, are very attuned. They're very aware of the potential of mobile. And they're actually progressively being bought off by the big mobile operators, who are the new monopolies in Africa. They've taken over from the previous monopolies. So now would be a very good time to make them aware of this. And I think particularly the two issues that have come up, standards that impact on use of energy, is a major issue in a part of the world where there is almost no, where most people don't have access to electricity. And it's a long-term issue anyway. And secondly, accessibility. If mobiles are is the answer to access for people that are living in poverty, that are illiterate, then issues of accessibility need to be built into all the services and applications. And there are lots. The companies, the private sector is competing at the moment with bidding for developing services and applications, e-government services, banking applications, e-health applications. So I think this is a very good time to make developing country governments and also the local industry players and the local developers aware of this issue.
I think John was next.
Yes, John Mathiasen from the Internet Governance Project. I may be able to give you some more food for thought because I'm preparing a book on internet governance, so I decided to look at standards. The IETF, W3C, and among other things, ISO, they have several things in common. All of them are dominated by the private sector companies who produce the technology. They are, as was noted, primarily northern companies, northern groups, although W3C has about, I think, 18% of the people who are listed as leading their groups from developing countries. So that's good. The question to raise is, ISO is also a kind of a consortium. ISO is this International Organization for Standards, which seems to do standards other than the standards we're talking about, but who knows? All of these three work on the same basis. They all work on the basis of consensus. They all work on the basis of very open-ended processes, which is not what governments do on the whole. In telecom, it's mostly has been historically the ITU, which does not work on the same basis. All four of them have a common characteristic that they go very slowly. A consensus takes time. And what you might want to consider this coalition doing is saying, look, we can't wait. We have to go faster. You guys, whoever are doing standards, have to make some priority choices. And I think some of the things that are mentioned are clearly key. Mobile phones. Anybody who comes from the United States is in real trouble if they go anyplace else because their mobile phone won't work. You may ask, why is that? And we know the answer. So one of the things to think about is to say, okay, these are the priority open systems issues. If we don't have interoperability in these things, if we don't deal with energy, which has come up in other places, hey, it is the system, the internet, which has got to be stable, it's got to be open, is going to be neither.
Thanks very much, John. And I think you were next. I have a follow-up question that doesn't really require an answer, but when we see countries setting some policies that they will procure products based on international standards, internationally accepted standards, what is the definition of an international standard? That's just a question, because in my opinion, something coming out of the IETF is an international standard. Something coming out of W3C. I just want to raise that issue because we're likely to see different definitions coming out of different places, and that could create issues.
A lot of the standards that we talk about are developed by individual, almost monopolistic companies. I mean, if you want, for example, Vista, which is the new Microsoft operating system, doesn't produce documents that can be read in the earlier systems, for example. You either have to buy Vista or a translator, for example. So it's an interesting problem.
Okay. So Daniel probably has an answer, and then we'll go over there.
Just to mention that the web is actually the only technology where you can take the first HTML document that was ever written, and you can submit it to your Internet Explorer or Firefox of today, and it will work. And the opposite is also true. You can take the first web server, and you can have it, you know, the first web browser and have it read a page of today, and it will degrade, you know, it will degrade in a way that is not crashing your system, in a sense.
Thank you. My name is Juan Carlos Solines. I'm from Ecuador. And I want to build on what Andrea just said a few minutes ago. Regarding developing countries, having been the regulator in my country until recently, I have the feeling that these standard discussions tend to be regarded in more and more in developing countries as huge fights between you know, corporations and different interests that are trying, you know, to impose their views. But behind there is always an economic and a commercial interest. So the approach that I think is more realistic for developing countries is regarding issues that create public value, no? like the ones they mentioned, interoperability, for example. In order to develop comprehensive regulation in terms of convergence, for instance, and in terms of developing new tools and platforms for technologies that have considerable penetration in developing countries, like mobile phones. So, for instance, the possibility to develop software and applications for mobile phones that will allow poor people in rural areas where there is no fixed networks to have access to the internet or to several contents. These are the issues that, in terms of standards, if standards promote and provide, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel and new tools for developing countries, would be relevant. Otherwise, regarding your question of international standards and what's the status, international standards are only one part of the equation. The other part is that the countries, locally adopting and adhering to these standards, they have the choice whether to do it or not. If they don't understand the meaning behind the standards, it's going to be very difficult. So I think that these discussions, the dynamic coalitions, should take that into account in order to discuss regarding values for countries that in which standards can help rather than, you know, specific cases or specific issues.
Sorry, I'm taking the microphone because it's close to me. Divina from EGGS. In WISIS, I was heading the Coalition for Education and Research, and we developed an open cognition platform and tried to promote OER, which is Open Educational Resources Online. And I just wanted to bring attention also to this aspect of open standards for content and not just for the technical dimensions of it. I've put my fight not so much in IGF, I must say, but on the action line on e-learning for reasons of strategy. And so we're trying to develop things with UNESCO and with ITU and other instances that way. But it's still at a very budding stage and very problematic stage. But I think education is key, and I know a lot of you here are sure about that. We have to fight for open education standards. It relies on open source. Governments don't understand that. They don't see economic models. OECD is starting to do investigation on these economic models of OERs. We have examples around the world, especially in developing countries, where it works. And one of the big issues, I think, at this moment is more to convince developed countries and also to reach levels that are not just small examples in different areas, but issues of scaling up, including via mobile phones, etc. So there's several issues, I think, that tie in with what has been said here. But we should really strategize with other places where this is also happening. Thank you.
If I may, just quickly, I just want to recap, I think, three things that maybe this coalition can work on over the next year would be, one, to what you just said, helping you to helping your constituents to understand the role of open technical standards in improving access to educational literature. To what Henriette said earlier, the first thing that kind of popped into my mind was just getting understanding and transparency into this whole thing. So of course I thought of the old, let's do an infographic, right? Break down what it looks like to have a mobile handset and the whole service and that like that. Where are all the, I mean, my God, this would be like 30 pages long, but you know, where are all, I mean, some of the key interface standards there. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't know the mic was on. I'm sorry. Anyway, you get the idea. Break that down. Where are those standards created? Who owns it? That type of stuff might be really interesting to do. And then to the gentleman here who's writing the book, I'm sorry, your comment on changes to the international de jure standards organizations, is the national bodies that govern how those organizations work, right? They have the, well, right, and then whoever controls and influences those national bodies. But maybe there's something that the coalition can do to educate those national bodies, a guide for national bodies, if you will, on issues in those organizations, perhaps. I don't know. Just trying to think of some concrete things we can do.
I just wanted to mention one thing later in the day. A new dynamic coalition is also forming around the issue of digital education, which hopefully you already know about. But if anyone is interested, there's going to be a workshop later today at, I think, 6:30 on that. So it'll be a new dynamic coalition.
My name is Felipe Sanchez. I'm from University of São Paulo. I have a question regarding accessibility, too. Some time ago, I talked to a friend that is visually impaired, and he told me that he absolutely hates websites that use Ajax technologies because it completely makes screen readers not work properly. I would like to know if there is something being worked in Ajax technology for accessibility.
Well, I don't know if Daniel wants to. I don't know Ajax specifically, but I know one, it's a solution that it happens at the end, not at the beginning, right? Accessibility should be from design from inception, but certainly there's lots of government regulation that for government services, government-provided e-services, they have to be accessible. So I would hope, say, within the U.S., we have Section 508 that governs that. It may not have the teeth, and departments may not really be held to account for that, but that is something we can, you know, raise more awareness of and do. And if Cynthia Waddell were here as well, she'd talk about the U.N. Again, this is something, its impact would be far down the road, but there's a new U.N. declaration or covenant around accessibility, too. But I don't, sorry if I'm making
Ajax is, in fact, sort of like using scripting, programming language in the web page to do more intelligent things. But when you do more intelligent thing, more algorithmic things, then it's harder for the user agent to actually understand the meaning of what you're doing. So as long as you're declaring what you're doing in simple HTML, saying this is a title, this is a list, this is my text, it's easy for the user agent to convert that in text and change the navigation, for instance. But if you start using a script and, you know, if then else and loop and whatnot, you know, in terms of imperative programming, then it becomes much harder, and the responsibility of the accessibility then lie into the hand of the programmer. You have to control the kind of modality that you're going to have. So it's kind of difficult to manage accessibility when you're talking about dynamic programming like that in web page. It's not impossible, it's just harder. And there is work on that. So if you go to the WAI site on W3C, then you'll find, you know, people looking at that.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Weremoni from MIT OpenCourseWare, and I wanted to ask the question, when in that great day in the future when the standards exist, you'll want to publish them somewhere, right? Will you intend to put them in the public domain? I agree. However, the public domain is not universal around the world. Each jurisdiction has a different definition of the public domain, so I raise that as a cautionary note in your strategic planning about how to make these standards globally accessible. And, you know, those are sort of hidden landmines in getting this stuff out there in the world. I don't have an answer or a solution. I just raise it as something to think about.
Just add on to that, another part of that is many of the business models of the standards organization depend upon a fee for use of those specifications, right? And that's one to be
Hello. Hi, my name is Jonathan Zook, and I'm with the Association for Competitive Technology. And we represent a lot of small businesses around the world. And I guess in terms of goals for a coalition like this, I think it might even be a mistake to make standards themselves the goal, but instead some of the underlying goals for which some of the reasons we approach standards, things like interoperability and accessibility, et cetera, might be more objective goals for a coalition like this. I think things like AJAX, things like HTML, dynamic HTML, Java, Flash, et cetera, there's a lot of experimentation still in building rich user experiences on the internet. And in many ways, the sort of cumbersome standards process, I think, could slow down the process of innovation, and that people ought to be able to experiment and not have everything immediately have to retrofit back into some baseline standard. It's most certainly not the case that an old browser can read every web page that's on the web right now. I mean, that isn't true, and nor do I think necessarily that it has to be. I think that there's experimentation that's going on. The example of the phones were brought up. The statement was made that you can't use a U.S. phone around the world, which I don't believe to be the case if you have a GSM phone. The phone that might not work around the world is a CDMA phone, so that was a different standard. But, you know, ironically, what's being discovered now in the world of data is that CDMA is actually a superior standard to GSM, and so countries like Romania are actually standardizing on CDMA instead of GSM. And so I think there also has to be room left in this environment for competition between standards, and that this rush to find some rush to the bottom, this rush to, commoditization of everything, I think could ultimately have a deleterious effect on innovation and competition generally. So we ought to be thinking in terms of interoperability, accessibility, access to educational materials, et cetera. Standards might be one way to get to that, particularly at a low level, but maybe not always the answer.
I'm Al Alegre from the Philippines, member of APC as well. I'd like to bring it back to one of the original sort of the guide questions about capacity building. Because we have technical people, but I think the broad network of APC are working more in advocacy and in ICT4D. So my concern is really to, we're coming from Creative Commons, for example, or FOSS, or A2K work, and standards, it's quite new for us, but it's obviously a part of the of the architecture of our open advocacies, no? So first two or three things on capacity building. One is for groups like us that don't have the technical aspect yet done, so we need the core documents and the core position sort of outlined and translated into as much languages as possible to get some sort of constituency building around the issues. Secondly, also to popularize it. Obviously, there are technical stuff and we don't deny that, but to make this a public interest issue, there has to be some level of popularization through primers, through whatever, through videos. I mean, all that we can think of to make this make people not be turned off that this is, wow, it's so technical or so legal. But also direct training activities are, I think, important for civil society organizations. Of course, the legal and international law aspect of this all, there has to be orientation on that. And the lawyers we work with, the public interest lawyers, on the other hand, do not have IT law as a basic background. So there has to be some sort of catching up as well in the public interest law community for these type of issues. Third point is state capacity, because in developing countries like ours, there is really a wide gap between the global sort of discourse and the capacity, whether it's financial, just to staff development and learning that happens in very poor bureaucracies in administrations like ours. So there are initial efforts. I'm not sure now, but I think the UNDP has a global interoperability framework project, for example, and that could be a good entry point. I think it's UNDP. So I agree with our colleague from Ecuador that interoperability, for example, is what the states are looking at, public administrations are looking at. Last one or two points. One is we have to also, in a sense, interface with the other advocacy. So my simple mind tells me that environmental standards, for example, will be taken up by the environmental groups very much. So if there is room for sort of interface in that on that level, so whether it's through equipment or e-waste or stuff that's coming out, well, energy was mentioned. Okay. And I'm not sure what the fast track method of how to get the advocates already who are into the open paradigm but don't know much about the standard sort of setting milieu is to have A2K camps, like we're from a tradition of open source camps, etc. But I don't know what the sort of the speedy way of getting people on board, because so it's a resource question as well. So let's not forget that as well, to get people in the same place and just talking face to face beyond just the IGF meetings. Thanks.
We're going until half past the hour, right? Or roughly. Okay, so let's get another one more comment back here, and then maybe talk about next steps, steering committee, who else wants to join the dynamic coalition and get involved, tangible things that we can do, the tough questions like that.
Hello. I would like to excuse, because I will try to introduce a more cultural approach to the discussion. Someone here said that we have a difficulty to define what would be a public domain. I would recommend to read Habermas, a German philosopher, that written about the public sphere. It would be very useful to IGF progress in the discussion. That's the first point. The second point is also another philosopher called Deleuze that make a point that I think it's very important to see what's happening now in IGF, right? We have practice and discourse. what you do is not exactly what you are saying you are going to do. For example, in this book that I found in the table, there is an article about ALAC, but ALAC is a distortion of at-large membership, and there is no mention, not an historical mention about at-large membership into the ICANN structure, for example, right? So we need to be very careful looking and using traditional instruments to evaluate the reality now and the historical background that we need to take in account to produce a better future. Thank you.
I'm going to turn it back to Susie, but I just, was there one more? Okay. But there's, someone wrote a dissertation linking Habermasian theories to standard setting, and I'll try to think of who that is, but that's a really good point.
Hi, thank you. The name's Ashraf from South Africa. One of the drivers of open standards in my country has been the need to develop the local IT industry. So government of South Africa over a period of time looked into open source, they looked at in the proprietary sector, they've done their research, and they adopted open standards for a whole range of reasons. Obviously, the basic minimum interoperability standards is now has been adopted. But what they saw is they saw value in open standards unleashing innovation, and innovation further developing the local industry. And I think that seems to be a key driver in many developing countries. On capacity, what we found is local standards organizations in the developing world lack zero capacity. Many of them are not sure of their tasks. Many of them are not sure how to regulate. So there's a massive gap in terms of developing countries, in terms of the capacity and understanding where open standards, interoperability fit. So there is a massive capacity building gap which we can take forward.
Thanks for that comment. Thanks for that comment. Is there anybody ever had any? Also for some more, we have had some good suggestions, but what could be some other work items that people think would be useful? I'm sure many of you are involved in your own dynamic coalitions, and obviously you're involved in these issues back in your own areas. I know, like I said, so one of the things that we had thought we'd do for this year that we didn't get done for next year would be just a good educational summary of how do standards work today? How does it work? What are the de jure organizations like, the industry consortia? That would be a nice primer. Anything else?
I'm Philip Schmidt. I'm based at the University of the Western Cape in Cape Town. And I work with an organization called Freedom to Innovate South Africa, which was quite involved in working with civil society across Africa who were looking at the OXML vote. And one problem we had that, first of all, it was important that it was local organizations that got involved with their standards bodies. But these civil society organizations were lacking support, international support in terms of expertise. And there were some very large companies, including IBM, including Sun to some degree, but not so active in Africa, who kind of stepped forward and said, we'll offer some expertise. There were some civil society organizations from Europe who offered expertise. But I think it would be useful to have a, there was always the perception that this is just the other side. So there's the company that's, you know, proposing the standard, and then there are these kind of anti-standards people, and the standards body is a little bit caught in between and feels like, who can we really trust? So I think a body like a dynamic coalition of the IGF has a lot more credibility. Maybe some people disagree in this room, but I would think that it has more credibility when civil society from Africa approaches them and brings those arguments into the discussion. The standards bodies would be more open to listen to those arguments than to arguments from kind of anti, particular lobbying campaigns that are Europe-based or other large international companies who have a different opinion than the company proposing the standards. So I think if there could be some kind of a resource or way to kind of send a request for information or support to this group, and then the members of the group could sort out how to respond to that, I think that would be very useful.
I think, like you said, how do we re-inject, if I may as well, the public interest into this, right? There's a way of vetting that. What is the public interest in these decisions? That's a good one. Did you have another?
Yes, it's easier to find the work items and to find people to actually work on them. But anyway, I will try. I believe, but I'm not sure, maybe I'm wrong, I believe that one of the problems when in the fight for open standard is that there is currently no strict definition of what an open standard is, and I mean a practical definition, something that could be applied to real standards and to yield an output of yes, it's open, no, it is not. We have this sort of thing for free software. We have several definitions of free software, but they basically yield the same result, so there is really no doubt that I don't know, the Linux kernel is free, but Internet Explorer is not. So for free software, it's more or less solved, but for open standard, I don't think it's solved. And when it comes down to specific standard, it seems there are always disagreement on whether they are open or not, because open is a buzzword. Everyone prefers things that are open, of course. But let me, for instance, mention a few standards and see if everyone agree on whether they are open or not. PDF, Java, SQL, XML, IPv6, Flash. For each of these standards, there are reasons to say that it is open or not. But I'm not sure that everyone agree on it. And there have been work done by some people like you on a definition of open standard, but as I don't think that we can say that there is a consensus at the present time. And even if there were a consensus, I'm not sure that it is widely known and widely applicable. So it seems to me that it could be an interesting work item. Yes, XML is free open standard. You will say so.
Very true what you said. If you go to Wikipedia for open standard, you only get the list of definition from various organizations. There is not a single consensus. It says that, you know, open standards are either free or not, you know, and then it gives a list from ITU, from the EC, from W3C, from the open source community, from French government, from, so, you know, it's there is no consensus yet. And honestly, I you know, I hope that this coalition will, you know, get to something at some point, but there is resistance, you know, because once you have a definition, then you have application of the definition, then you may lose, you know, some of the statute quo that you have today.
Anything else that anyone on the steering committee wanted to add? Rashad, anything you want to add to that? All right. Well, you know, thank you. I feel a little awkward. This wasn't supposed to be us. Thank you for everybody in the audience who did participate. So I do hope that people, if you come up and give us your business cards, me your business cards, we'll sign you up for the mailing list. Again, it's at www.igf-dcause.org. It's also on the papers that we have up here, our statements from last year. We're open to participation from you guys. We want to hear your input on what you think that we need to do for next year. And I do hope that we come back with some more tangible and structured help for next year. We'll certainly have more workshops like this. So. Anything else? We have another workshop, like Laura said, too. We actually have another one starting in an hour that's some best practices on how Sri Lanka and the Extremadura region of Spain have used open standards interoperability to deliver some government services and the problems they had and some of the successes they had. So please join us for that. Otherwise, let's chat informally. Thanks. Ooh, I'll also put a plug in for two other things I forgot. Laura has an excellent paper on the role, the political implications of standards that if you give her your business card, I'm sure she'll give you. And then for anybody who wants to really, really geek out on this, there's a great book that was published in 1995 called Interfaces on Trial, Interoperability in the Global Software Industry. It's fascinating about the business history. And is that Habermas you're gonna make me read?